Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
On the morning of May 6, 2014, Russell Dermond, an 88-year-old beloved father and husband, was found dead in the garage of his home on Lake Oconee in Georgia. In addition to this horrific scene, Russell's wife of 62 years, Shirley Dermond, was nowhere to be found. An intense search for her began, and on May 16th, she was found in the lake. Shirley had also been murdered, and her body was weighed down with concrete blocks. Despite a thorough investigation, the police have yet to identify a motive or suspect for this heinous crime. It's been just over 10 years since Russell and Shirley were killed, and investigators are still searching for the person or people responsible. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Lavasser. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective, and each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. So a quick announcement before we get into this week's episode. It's actually some pretty big news. Detective Perspective has been nominated for a Clue Award. It's hosted by CrimeCon, if you're not familiar with the Clue Awards, and we are up for Outstanding Episodic Series in a Podcast. So it's a pretty big deal. We've only been doing this for approximately 9 months. Whether we win or lose, it's irrelevant, and I'm not just saying that to say, you know, because that's the right thing to say, but it's a big win for true crime either way. I've said it before, I'll say it again. I've been in the true crime genre since 2017, and I've heard from a lot of quote-unquote experts that unsolved cases just don't work, whether it's on TV or podcast, because people want resolution, so cases like the ones we cover here are just quote unquote not entertaining enough, and people, they don't stick around. The retention's just not there. So it's great to see a show like this being recognized for an award by individuals who are in the industry. That's the judges on the panel. This wasn't voted on by fans. It's strictly by a group of individuals who work in this field from different backgrounds, and Detective Perspective was nominated. So thank you to the panel. Thank you to CrimeCon. And most importantly, thanks to you guys, both on audio and on video. There's no doubt that when they're reviewing these episodes, they're looking to see what type of engagement, what type of listenership or viewership the show gets. I don't think they're picking shows that have 10 views. So although, you know, maybe they should. But overall, it's because of you guys that we're in this position, and we work really, really hard on the show. Haley with the script writing and researching, and Shannon with the editing. And then obviously me coming in here all hours of the night. Tonight it's 2 o'clock in the morning to get this stuff done and to get it out on time, because these cases are important and there's real people behind these stories. So this is our way of giving back to the true crime genre, which has been so good to me over the years. And again, I couldn't do it without you guys. So thank you very much. All right. So now to this week's case, and I'm going to make it very brief because I can summarize it in a few sentences. This case has my brain in a pretzel. It's that simple. I was literally just running on the treadmill before coming in here, and I was reviewing the autopsy report for Russell, and it all to me just, it could be one thing, it could be the other. I go back and forth. I've been kind of reviewing this case now for over a week, and one day I have my notes written out, and I think I'm going to come and say this to you, and then the next day I feel completely differently after driving to work or driving to, you know, the store and thinking about this case over and over again. So I'm really looking forward to giving you guys all the details, giving you some of my opinions on it, tell you where I stand as of right now. I'm really looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say about this case, especially the self-proclaimed web sleuths, because this one, as far as motive, as far as how it was conducted, how it was carried out in a way where there was little to no detection by anyone around them, even after the fact by law enforcement. Was it a professional? Was it someone who is just lucky? We're going to dive into all of it tonight. So with that out of the way, let's dive into the case. Russell and Shirley Derman were married on December 15, 1951. They later welcomed three sons and one daughter, and Shirley became a stay-at-home mother in the family's New Jersey home. The Derman son, Brad, later shared with WTSP that Russell and Shirley were all about family. They cherished spending time together and were wonderful people. In the 1980s, Russell decided that he wanted to leave something behind for his loved ones, so he retired and entered the fast food business in Atlanta, Georgia. Before long, he was managing a chain of 16 Hardee's restaurants. According to the Atlanta Constitution, although the Dermans were financially comfortable, they weren't flashy about it. A friend described them as modest, quiet, and unassuming people. In 1994, the Dermans purchased around an acre of land in Reynolds Plantation, a gated community located right off Lake Oconee in Georgia. Their property sat on Carolyn Drive, which was a cul-de-sac, and it overlooked a cove and was surrounded by thick trees. 5 years later, they built a 3,000-square-foot home on that land. And we're going to have some photos up here where you'll see some satellite views, and you'll also see some photos of the house. And from what I can tell, it was an extremely nice home on an amazing piece of property. As a fisherman myself, having that lakefront property would have been amazing. And I know the Dermans didn't own a boat, but I can only imagine what it would be like to sit out by that lake and just enjoy the scenery. For the next 15 years or so, the couple enjoyed their retirement in this home. Shirley played bridge and filled out crossword puzzles, while Russell read, took walks, and played golf. They cherished whatever time they could with their four children and nine grandchildren. They also socialized with neighbors. One neighbor later told the Macon Telegraph that nobody had anything negative to say about the Dermans. Everyone always talked about how kind they were. On May 3, 2014, the Dermans were supposed to attend a Kentucky Derby viewing party at their neighbor's, but they didn't show up. Multiple people tried calling to check on them, but they never answered. On May 4th and May 5th, there still wasn't any response from the couple, which was extremely unusual for them. Finally, on May 6th, the neighbors decided to check on the Dermans. They found the front door unlocked, which was odd, and there was no signs of forced entry. Inside, Russell and Shirley were nowhere to be found, so the neighbors went to the attached garage. Once there, they discovered 88-year-old Russell lying face up in a pool of dried blood. He had been beheaded. 87-year-old Shirley Derman wasn't in the garage or anywhere in the house for that matter, and she appeared to be missing. The neighbors immediately called the police, who rarely, if ever, were called to the Reynolds Plantation. The area itself had a crime rate of zero. There had never even been a reported burglary, and now a horrifying murder had occurred. When Putnam County Sheriff Howard Sills and his officers arrived at the Derman home, they headed straight for the garage. Inside, they found two parked cars, a Lincoln and an SUV. According to 11 Alive, Russell, who showed signs of mild decomposition, was lying between the two cars. His torso and arms were aligned with the back of the SUV, and he was wearing a short-sleeved shirt and a pair of boxers. Also worth noting is that he was laying on top of a robe while his slippers were tossed to the side. Russell's bare feet were stained with blood, and there was a faint red trail smeared from the door all the way to his body. Towels were also placed around him, presumably to prevent blood from leaking under the garage door. Russell's hands were bruised and bloody, with a severe gash on the left index finger, which also had strands of Shirley's hair tangled within it. Now, the police believe this suggested a struggle between the Dermans and their attacker, which is the obvious conclusion, but you never know. It could be from a lot of things, but that's obviously an option. Now, according to the Macon Telegraph, the police found no blood spatter around Russell's headless body, suggesting that his beheading wasn't the cause of death. They noticed gunpowder residue on the collar of his shirt, which led them to believe that he had been shot and then his head was removed so the bullet couldn't be traced. Now, I could save this to the end, but I think it's better to address it right here. Is this a possibility that this person went to this extreme, shooting Russell in the head and then removing his entire head just to avoid the projectile from being retrieved by law enforcement? I guess that's possible, but I'm no ballistics expert, but in my experience, you're not normally, maybe you can get the caliber, but you're definitely not going to be able to link a projectile back to a specific firearm. Shell casings can do that. There's some science behind it, striations, firing pin indentation, some other things that can be involved. But with the projectile itself, the way it gets smashed as it comes out of the barrel of the gun, there's really no identifiable marks that can be traced back to a specific gun. So to go to this extreme, if this wasn't intentional just for the murder itself, seems excessive. And if they're experts, if these are contract killers, they would have known what I'm saying right now, although they could be uneducated and just misinformed. To me, I think the beheading is more about a message. I don't understand why you would go to this length if it were just for forensic reasons. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But as we go through this case and you hear how it unfolds, maybe you'll agree with me, maybe you'll agree with law enforcement. Now, there was also no evidence of a bullet hole anywhere, leading police to question if Russell had been killed in the garage or if he had been killed somewhere else. All they knew for sure is that the head had been removed there and then the offenders took it with them. Later, an autopsy revealed that Russell's head was removed with, quote, a single clean cut. And since his head wasn't available for examination, the cause of death was only described as cranial cerebral trauma. And you see, this point right here to me is even more indicative of a premeditated plan where the beheading was decided before they ever arrived. And the reason I say that is there's no indication that something from the home was used to behead Russell. So in that case, that means this instrument was brought by the offender or offenders. And if that's the case, if they went to this extent as far as planning, and they were so concerned about leaving behind something that can be traced back to them, why use a gun in the first place? Russell was 88 years old. Shirley was 87 years old. They're not going to put up much of a fight. You can use other weapons that are something that's not going to be as traceable as a projectile or a shell casing from a firearm. It appears to me that, and we're going to get more into the other facts of this case, I don't want to get too far ahead, but it appears to me, based on the defensive wounds just on Russell alone, that there may have been a sharp object that was involved, a weapon, and that alone could have killed him. Why go to the extent of shooting him and then having to remove his head and then taking that head with you, which could potentially put you in a bind if you're caught by law enforcement or if that head leaves behind some type of trace evidence in your vehicle or on your clothing? It just seems like a lot of unnecessary risk unless the head was taken to send a message. We're going to get back into this. We have a lot to cover, but before we do, let's take our first break.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Moro Casino, America. like a social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Okay, we're back. Let's keep going with what police discovered inside the Durman home. Now, as I said earlier, there wasn't any sign of forced entry or struggle. The only thing that seemed off was a crooked lampshade in the living room. Now, this lampshade caught Sheriff Sills' attention because everything else in the house was perfectly neat. And Sills told the Macon Telegraph, quote, "There is nothing out of place. Everything seems immaculate. This is the cleanest house I've ever been in." Now, it's important to note that Shirley was known to keep a very clean house, so it's possible the house was already clean and it wasn't the perpetrator that cleaned up after the attack. During the search, the police didn't find any potential murder weapons in the house, but what they did find I thought was very interesting, and that was Shirley and Russell's wallets and phones, along with valuables such as jewelry and sterling silver. Now, if this was financially motivated, you would expect at least some of those items to be missing as well, and yet they were all there. The latest issue of USA Today was left open on the kitchen table, and it appeared that Shirley had been working on a crossword puzzle. The couple's bed was unmade, and as I mentioned earlier, Russell was still in his pajamas. The couple's children later told the police that this all matched up with their morning routine. Throughout the house, there was no sign of Shirley anywhere and no sign that she had been injured in any way. The police worried that she had been abducted, so they called in the FBI and asked the public to keep an eye out for her and to call if they had any tips. Authorities then began an intense search for Shirley. The Macon Telegraph reported that the police dragged the lake near the couple's house and used sonar to look underwater. They also used cadaver dogs to search the nearby woods, but they didn't find anything. The police had no idea where Shirley could be, and as days went by with no sign of her, the police and the Durman children had less hope she'd be found alive. While they looked for Shirley, the police also processed the Durman home for evidence, and they took quite a bit of forensic evidence from the scene, hundreds of fingerprints, hair, and even tissue samples. The police also tried to figure out exactly when Russell and Shirley were last seen alive. The Union Recorder reported that the Durmans didn't have surveillance cameras inside or outside their home, and neither did their neighbors. The gated community itself did have surveillance, but unfortunately, this is just the way it goes sometimes, the cameras were not working because of a storm that had just passed through a few weeks before the murder. And interestingly enough, no one even knew the cameras weren't working until the murder occurred. Now, even though the cameras weren't working, the entrance of the gated community was guarded. And when a visitor showed up, the guards needed to hear confirmation from the residents before allowing them inside. However, this rule did not apply to service companies with a decal. They could enter freely and their license plates were not documented, and this included visitors as well. They never took down the plates, which I'm sure after this occurred, that changed. And I do want to point something out because I'm sure a lot of you are sitting there right now shaking your head saying, how did something like this happen in such a well-protected community? But it's important to note that there was nothing preventing anyone from entering the community on the lakeside. So if the offenders owned a boat or some type of water vehicle, they could have gained access to the Durman home via their dock because, as I mentioned, the Durmans did not own a boat. So that is also an option as well, and we definitely can't rule that out. And as we go forward in this story, that scenario may even make more sense to you. So back to the cameras. Obviously, since the police didn't have security footage, they had to piece together the Durman's last moves using other methods. And using those methods, they found out that on May 1st, 5 days before Russell was discovered dead, he went to the bank, then to the grocery store where he bought bread and cucumbers and picked up prescriptions for Shirley for her upcoming cataract surgery. This trip was recorded on camera and was the last confirmed sighting of Russell. The reason I say confirmed is because a neighbor told the police that on May 2nd, they saw Russell walking on a nearby golf course. This is the last unofficial sighting of Russell. Now, what's interesting about the unofficial sighting is later that day, if he had been seen on the 2nd, the Durman's mail was delivered, but they didn't take it out of the mailbox. And then obviously, as we know, the following day was the Kentucky Derby party, which the couple missed. So is it possible that Russell was seen at the golf course earlier that day and whatever happened to the couple happened between the time that he got back and the time that the mail was delivered? Yes, it's possible, but as I've said to you guys many times before, this witness could have had good intentions, but depending on how sure they were of the date and time, it's possible that they got their weeks or even days confused, and maybe what they thought was the May 2nd was actually the 1st or was the 30th of April. There's a lot of scenarios there, so I tend to go with the last confirmed sighting, which we have on camera, and it would make more sense because think about this. If Russell is out of the golf course earlier that morning, is he going to come home after golfing and get back into his pajamas? I don't think so. More than likely, the reason that Russell was in his pajamas when he was found was because that's what he was wearing when he woke up. But I will say this, there might have been something in that testimony that law enforcement was able to corroborate or find credible, that maybe Russell was seen at the golf course that morning, because based on everything they learned, they guessed that Russell and Shirley were attacked sometime between 4:30 p.m. on May 2nd, which is when the mail arrived, and 4 p.m. on May 3rd, which is when the Kentucky Derby party began. Now, during their initial investigation, the police also conducted a lot of interviews. They spoke to more than 200 residents from the community, asking if they had seen anything suspicious from May 2nd through May 4th. The only thing we know about these interviews is that a neighbor saw a man on the Derman property around the time the crime might have happened, but that's all they've ever said publicly. We don't know if it was just one neighbor or multiple neighbors. They've never given a description, so I don't know how credible this information is. The police also interviewed anyone who could have been in the neighborhood around the time the Dermans were attacked. This included landscapers, maintenance workers, even the mailman. But they didn't find any suspects that appeared to be credible after administering multiple polygraph exams. Now, the Derman children, who all lived out of state, were also thoroughly questioned and were fully cooperative. And from talking to the children, the police learned that the couple was religious about locking their doors, and they also had a security system, which obviously was not armed at the time when the attack occurred. While the police put together a timeline for the Dermans' last movements, searched for Shirley, and conducted interviews, they were also trying to figure out why anyone would want to hurt the Dermans. Essentially, what was the motive? And because of the way Russell's body was found, the FBI also looked into any signs of organized crime. They checked phone and financial records and talked to many people, but they found nothing useful. Sheriff Sills told the Macon Telegraph, quote, "We're hearing nothing but glorious accolades about these people." Now, on the surface, you might say, oh, that's great. You would, that's what you want to hear, that these people were good people. But I will tell you, behind closed doors, law enforcement is hoping for a break. Although this is not the outcome they want, they're trying to figure out what happened, not only to Russell, but also to Shirley. She could still be alive. So I will tell you, behind closed doors, as they're going through these financial records and looking at this call history as well, they're hoping that something pops up that suggests, oh, okay, this is a bad group of people that they were talking to, that they were dealing with. This is a lead. This is something we need to follow up on. But when you're coming back and it's nothing but squeaky clean, yes, on one hand, it's a good thing. But as far as the investigation is concerned, as far as trying to find new things to follow up on, it can be a little demoralizing for the detectives. So they're going through everything, and they still can't figure out why this happened to the Dermans. And Sheriff Sills even came out and said they didn't believe that this crime was committed by, quote, some traveling serial killer, because, quote, it's not the type of neighborhood for a random crime. And I completely agree with him. If you go back and you look at the satellite map and you look at the area and you look at the security measures that are in place for that gated community, when a potential killer is looking for victims of opportunity, this is not the area they're going to choose. There's a lot of hurdles you have to jump to get to the Dermans. Why would you go through all of that when you could go to any area of the town and find 5 or 10 people who are easier to gain access to? So I completely agree with Sheriff Sills here. I don't believe this was some random act of violence, and I definitely don't believe it was some random transient who was just passing through the area looking for a thrill kill. It just, It just doesn't fit that MO. In addition to dispelling the whole traveling serial killer theory, Sheriff Sills also talked about Shirley's disappearance and stated that if it was an abduction, they would have expected some type of ransom note, and if it was an assassination, both bodies would have been left at the house. And I couldn't agree more. This is what has me so confused about this story. It seems like there were two different crimes occurring here. Maybe the offender or offenders kind of switched up halfway through, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. We've seen other scenarios where if there's an intent, if this is financially motivated, you take someone and then you reach out with either a note or a phone call. None of that was done. And as we go through this story and it kind of unfolds, maybe that will make sense as to why they never reached out. But on the surface, yeah, if this was a contract hit, you kill both Russell and Shirley, you leave them there, you get out. So if this was all premeditated, then taking Shirley, there was a plan. There was something that was supposed to happen, and it never did. Now, the Derman son, Keith, told the Atlanta Constitution that he and his siblings couldn't think of anyone who would want to hurt their parents. They thought that maybe they had been targeted due to their nice house, or maybe it was a case of mistaken identity. Now, I'll never rule this out completely, but I will say on the surface, it doesn't sound like it to me. It seems like the offender or offenders knew exactly who they were there for, and once they confirmed that they were the right people, they carried out whatever plan had already been set in place. But again, you can't rule it out completely. Maybe these quote-unquote professional killers weren't as smart as they thought they were, and it wouldn't be the first time that the wrong people were killed. But personally, I don't think that's the case. So there's a lot going on, and theories are starting to be thrown out, and there's still a lot of unanswered questions. The most important question being, where's Shirley? Well, on May 16th, 10 days after Russell was found murdered, two fishermen were in the middle of Lake Oconee, around 5 miles from the Derman home, when they came across Shirley's body. It had floated on a cluster of treetops and was barely beneath the water's surface. Shirley's body was weighed down with two 30-pound red concrete blocks, which was inside a blue mesh bag. And according to Shirley's autopsy report, she was wearing a short-sleeved shirt, pants, socks, and sneakers. Now, the autopsy also revealed that Shirley had suffered blunt force trauma to her head, resulting in a fractured skull and bleeding in her brain. Because the fractures were circular, the medical examiner suggested that the weapon used may have had a rounded or circular end, like a hammer. And apart from at least two hits to Shirley's head, there were no other significant signs of trauma to her body. The autopsy further concluded that after her death, Shirley's ankles were tightly bound with paracord. The cord was wrapped around both socks, 5 times around both ankles, and 3 times around each ankle individually before she was attached to the blocks and submerged in the water. Now, because of this discovery, the police searched the lake for Russell's head, but unfortunately, they didn't find it, and that wasn't too surprising because the lake is full of sunken tree branches and debris, which makes it very difficult for divers and sonar to spot anything. And as of this recording, Russell's head has never been found. According to the Atlanta Constitution, the police theorized that Shirley's body wasn't supposed to be found, unlike Russell's. Finding Shirley's body so far out in the lake made them think that a boat might have been used to reach the Derman home in the first place. They further believed that Shirley's body was taken across the water in the dark because it would have been difficult to move her during the day without being seen. Sheriff Sills said this led him to theorize that whoever the killer was, they knew exactly where they were going and how to get there, especially in the dark. Now, Sills went on to say that this doesn't necessarily mean that the killer was a local, but it does show they were very familiar with the lake. We're going to take our last break. We'll be right back.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot.
Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic.
Keep your eyes on the road.
Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly.
Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Okay, so we're back, and by the end of May of that same year, the police still hadn't come up with a motive or any suspects. Now, Sheriff Sills came out publicly and said the Dermans were, quote, probably targeted because of something they had, or something people thought they had, or some sort of extortion that didn't go through. Now, after this public statement, there were very few updates until November, when the Atlanta Constitution reported that at this point, only Sheriff Sills and one other detective was working on the case. They were going through thousands of pages of financial documents and phone records, as well as interviewing family, friends, and business associates. Some of those people even took polygraph tests, but there were still no solid leads and no suspects. Sheriff Sills told the Atlanta Constitution that they still hadn't found any possible motives. There was nothing bad in the Dermans' background, and to quote Sheriff Sills exactly, no criminal connections, nothing. But a few things had changed in Sheriff Sills' theory of what happened. He now believed it was possible the killers arrived by car and that they were not locals. They were from the, quote, hoodlum world. Whatever that means, you'll have to ask him. At the one-year mark, Sheriff Sills told the Atlantic Constitution that they were no closer to solving the case than they were on day one. Sills went on to say that he was, quote, convinced the people who killed the Dermans knew the Dermans. They knew the house to some extent. They'd been there before. According to Sills, Russell's death appeared to be the work of a professional, but Shirley's did not. He explained that a professional wouldn't, quote, beat a woman, then tie her down with inadequate anchoring. Sheriff Sills also revealed that some people had speculated that the Derman children might have been involved, but they all had solid alibis, cooperated fully with the investigation, and passed all polygraph tests. He also said that authorities believe that Shirley's death points away from a potential financial motive for the children because Russell and Shirley were each other's executors, so if she had remained missing like they believe the killer wanted, her assets would have been frozen, meaning the children wouldn't have gotten anything. After these revelations, years went by without any significant updates, but then in May of 2019, around the five-year mark since the Dermans were killed, Sheriff Sills told the Macon County Telegraph that he now believes the murders might have been related to some type of extortion or robbery, and the Dermans didn't have what the perpetrators wanted. He believed that more than one person was involved and Shirley wasn't killed in the house. When you consider the injury she had, there would have likely been some type of physical evidence left behind, and they didn't find anything. Sills also mentioned that it was possible that Russell wasn't killed at the house either. All they knew for sure is that his head was removed there. That's all the forensic evidence confirmed. And as far as the differing methods of killing both Russell and Shirley, this to him also indicated potentially two different killers. Now at this point, although it seems like Sheriff Sills' heart is in the right place, we always are out here saying we need more information, we want law enforcement to be forthright and truthful and honest with us and give us whatever they have. This is one of those few situations where I almost wish Sheriff Sills would say less, because it feels like at this point he's just guessing, and his guess is just as good as any of ours. And listen, that's not me knocking him. He himself has come out publicly and said that they're no closer to solving this case than they were the day it fell on their lap. So if that's really true, then he's in no better position than us. Now, the investigation into the Dermans' murders continued with very few updates over the years. But then in May of 2023, Sheriff Sills told WSB TV2 that he sent the evidence to Othram Labs, and they found new DNA. Now, there wasn't a follow-up on this information until April 24th, 2024, which was only a few weeks ago. At that time, it was revealed that the DNA Othram found did not belong to the Dermans, which was obviously a good sign. And as of this recording, the lab is currently trying to find enough DNA to submit it to criminal and genealogical databases. Sheriff Sills told 11 Alive that he can't rule out the possibility that the DNA might belong to a law enforcement officer, investigator, state crime lab technician, or someone else who had been involved in the case. But if it doesn't belong to any of those people, then it's likely connected to whoever was involved in the Dermans' murders. The Derman son Brad told WSB-TV2 that the new evidence is giving him a bit of hope that the killer might be found. He mentioned that from the moment he and his siblings found out about their parents' murders, they were, quote, in total horror. All these years later, and they still don't have any idea why Russell and Shirley were killed or who was involved. And even though it's tough knowing what their parents went through, Brad and his siblings keep pushing forward. They have never lost hope that their parents' murders will be solved.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Okay, now for my perspective, and I did it a little different tonight. I kind of gave my perspective throughout the episode, which I've done before. I feel like it flows a little better. But just to kind of summarize here, we know as much as law enforcement. They've been very forthright with what they do know, so I feel like we have the full picture. They've kind of given away a lot of the details. Like I said earlier when I started this episode, the autopsy has been released. I had the ability to view that. So I feel like we have a pretty good idea of the evidentiary value involved in this case. The only thing that we don't know as of right now, which has the most potential, is this DNA at Othram Labs. And they're a great laboratory. And if anybody's going to be able to figure out the DNA profile and get that into sequencing and then get that over to some genealogist that can actually do something with it, it's Othram. There's Othram, Intermountain Forensics, they're the top dogs. If they have the DNA, if there's something that can be done with it, they will find a way. So that's very promising. But as Sheriff Sill said, there's still a strong potential with how many people were involved with this case that DNA belongs to someone who is working the investigation. I hope that's not the case, but we have to prepare for that just in case. But as far as what happened here, I kind of alluded to it throughout the episode. For me, I think that this was a targeted attack. I don't know what the motive would be for attacking an 88 and 87-year-old couple. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but it seems pretty well thought out. And I think when you talk about the guarded security area that you have coming in and out of there, I don't think our offenders drove through that access point. I think more than likely they were on some type of watercraft, whether it was a boat or jet skis. I don't know what it would have been. I would think a boat. And the reason I would say a boat is because there's multiple items that are either missing or were used in this crime that don't appear to be from the Derman home. What am I talking about? The red concrete blocks, the blue mesh bag, the hammer, the sharp object that was used to behead Russell. Where are these items? And if they were from the household, would the children or law enforcement have reported that items used in these crimes were taken from the home? Yes, I guess the hammer could have been from the garage or something like that. Maybe they just didn't notice that it was missing. As I said earlier, the children are not from in-state. So is it fair to say that they wouldn't know if their dad's hammer was missing if they came up to the crime scene? Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair assumption to make. But the red concrete blocks and the blue mesh bag and the paracord, were these items from the home? If they were, why hasn't the police said that? Were these concrete blocks from the area at all? Were they able to tie them back to a neighboring house or anything in the area. If not, then that means they were brought there for this specific purpose. So again, I think that this was a premeditated double homicide that was well planned, and where I think it kind of went off the rails, it appears to me that they killed Russell at the house. They showed up in the morning. He was still in his pajamas. They catch him off guard. There's an attack. There's some type of struggle that goes on. That's why he's injured on his hands. And they kill him there. And they leave him there. They cut off his head and they leave him there to send a message to someone. Who that someone is, I don't know. It definitely wasn't Shirley. And I think the initial plan was to take Shirley, but for some reason, those plans changed. And they decided to kill her and leave her in the lake, hoping that she would never be found. I don't know why that is. I can't tell you why. I think initially it may have been some type of extortion plot, but then last minute they decided against it. Maybe they felt like it was too hot and they felt like it was going to connect back to them. Maybe they got cold feet. Maybe Shirley was just too combative and they were unable to control her. There's a lot of scenarios that could have played out here, but for whatever reason, they felt like having Shirley alive was too much of a risk. I do agree with law enforcement's theory that Shirley was not killed in the home, and it's kind of going along with the theory that I'm laying out for you right now. Let's say she had been struck in the head with a hammer and they fractured her skull. More than likely, you would have some evidence of either high-velocity blood spatter or low-velocity blood spatter from the injury as she was leaving the home. Apparently, you have none of that. So it is indicative of her being injured while either on a boat or in a vehicle or somewhere else. So what may have happened is they get out on the boat, they have a change of heart, they decide, you know what, we can't keep her alive. They don't want to shoot her because maybe it's going to be too loud and someone may hear it and then see them. So they use something that's on the boat or something they had in case they needed to go with a quieter approach. They strike her twice in the head with the hammer. They weigh her down, throw her in the water 5 miles from the home, and they hope that she'll never be found again, either through predation or she'll just stay down there. And again, it's a huge lake with sonar and divers. It's going to be hard to find her in the first place. So it does appear that they were banking on her never being found. Maybe down the road, there would have been some type of extortion plot that would have come to the surface, and maybe it would have been toward one of the children, but that never came to fruition, and we'll never know. As far as this case being solved, I really think it hinges on the DNA currently at Othram Labs. We need this DNA through exclusionary practices to rule out everybody involved with this investigation. And if they are able to do that, then there's only a few people left that DNA could belong to, one of them being the killer or killers. So if we get to that point, then genealogists can take over and start to develop a profile and maybe find a familial match. Even if it's not the killer, they could find maybe a family member, and that's how the ball starts rolling. That's how they solve the Golden State Killer. So I'm not losing hope in this one. I really think that with this DNA out there, anything's possible, and if we're able to solve this case, this is the way it's going to be done. But just to recap, in case, as always, if someone out there knows something and maybe something in this story kind of jogs something in your memory, if you have something, come forward and make sure you let the investigators know what you have and let them decide whether it's important or not. So just to recap, Russell and Shirley Derman were killed sometime between 4:30 p.m. on May 2nd, 2014 and 4 p.m. on May 3rd. They were possibly killed at their home on Carolyn Drive in Reynolds Plantation, a gated community right off Lake Oconee in Georgia. Russell was discovered in the garage. He was likely shot in the head and then decapitated. As for Shirley, she suffered 2 blows to the head, possibly from a hammer. Her body was then weighed down, and her body was dumped in the lake. So if you have any information about this case, please call the Putnam County Sheriff's Office at 706-485-8557. There is a $25,000 reward available. As for the Derman family, specifically Brad and his siblings, we're thinking about you. We know right now it's probably a weird time for you. You have this advancement in science and technology where there's a potential to find your parents' killer or killers. And I know that that's a situation where you don't want to get too much hope, but deep down, you're really hoping this is the answer. And we're really hoping it's the answer for you as well, because you guys deserve it. And most importantly, your parents deserve it. So we'll be thinking about you. And if there's any updates in this case, we will let everybody know. That's going to do it for me, guys. Everyone stay safe out there. I'll see you next week.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.